Good evening and welcome to The Final Draft, where we talk books and writing for 2SER. I'm Netta Vanavak. Have you ever wondered how to read a novelist? Not just what they write, but who they are, or rather who we think they are, reading between their lines and superimposing our own lives upon theirs? Have you ever tried to figure out what makes them tick, the layers they dress their characters in, the way they lay themselves bare, and the things they keep secret? Well, tonight we have two very special interviews for you unravelling just that. Kate Barraston speaks with the very prolific Lily Brett about her new novel Lola Bensky, which is loosely based on her own past as a rock journalist in the 60s and 70s. And then later in the show, we'll hear from John Freeman, editor of Grant Literary Magazine, who's interviewed just about every big name in literature that you can think of, and probably a few you can't. His book is How to Read a Novelist. Both of those coming up, so stay with us.
I love that 2SER, I can come in here after a day's work and present a show and do a segment, and that anyone can be a participant.
I love 2SER because I can get naked to it.
I love vegan cake.
I love that it's something that I can contribute to, and that it's local, it's accessible, and we are able to talk about things that are important to us.
Share the love. Support Real Radio. Call 9514 9500 or go to 2ser.com. You're listening to The Final Draft. And as you're probably hearing, it's supporter drive at the moment here at the station, the second and final week of our fundraising for this year. Sometimes easy to lose track of all the things we do here at 2SER. Community radio can have a tough time sometimes getting alternate voices out there. And 2SER is pretty proud of the diversity of our content. We've got the most diverse content, in fact, of any radio station in Sydney, with more than 100 interviews a week, and only two of those this week are for Final Draft, so you can imagine what else is out there. Every week we challenge and discuss the issues of the day with politicians, artists, musicians, academics and filmmakers. We've been showcasing Australian music with over half of this year's feature albums from Australian artists. We've hosted free events for Sydney Fringe Festival, nearly 12 months of free broadcasts and performances as part of Live at the Loft, and we've developed a phone app so you can have even better access to quality community radio on the go. So if you've been enjoying some of the conversations we've had with some amazing writers on Final Draft this year, well-known and emerging, we'd love you to consider helping keep us on air. The number to call to subscribe is 9514 9500. This past year alone, we've interviewed Anna Funda, Alex Miller, Chloe Hooper, Drusilla Majeska, Jeff Sparrow and Anthony Lowenstein, Kathy Lett, Nick Earls, Anita Heiss, scientists, translators, jazz poets, graphic artists. We've covered live events, broadcast stories, and that is just the tip of the literary iceberg. We're not even close to being done for 2012. So please think about subscribing. All new supporters, everyone who signs up over the next 2 weeks, will go into the major prize draw to win a year's worth of entertainment, which includes a Belvoir Theatre season pass, 12 months of movies from Palace Cinemas, a year's worth of gigs from The Basement, 4 CDs a month for a whole year from Inertia, 2 DVDs a month from Hopscotch, and an Ox digital radio to tune into 2SER loud and clear all year long. The concession annual rate is just $35, $70 for a standard, $150 for passionate supporters, and $600 for lifetime sponsorship, which, if you think sounds like a lot, isn't when you consider that it will get you 50 CDs of the best new music from the last year, or tickets for you and a friend to Pete's Ridge Music Festival to celebrate New Year's Eve, complete with camping and parking for 3 days. So if you like us, please help support community radio. You can give us a ring now on 9514 9500.
2SER 107.3. Real radio, now broadcasting in digital.
Lily Brett, best-selling author of books such as Too Many Men, is back with a new one that dips into her past incarnation as a music journalist in the 1960s. Lola Bensky is a 19-year-old Australian music journalist who has managed to wrangle herself a job interviewing musicians in London, holding her own with Jimi Hendrix and Mick Jagger while juggling her family's difficult history as survivors of the Holocaust. Kate Barraston caught up with Lily to talk about facing your teenage self, what people are really capable of, and using fiction as a confessional.
Lola Bensky was sitting on an uncomfortably high stool. She could feel the nylon threads of her fishnet tights digging into her thighs. She had put a wad of tissues underneath the fishnet on the inside of each of her thighs. The tissues, which were supposed to stop her thighs rubbing against each other and chafing her skin, had shredded. and now her flesh poked through the mesh in small, shiny, tightly packed pink squares. She tried to move into a more comfortable position. She didn't like sitting on stools, and she didn't like heights. She noticed a sprinkling of disintegrated tissue on the floor below her left foot. She decided to sit very still and to go on a diet. Jimi Hendrix, who was sitting on a slightly lower stool, looked at her.
That was from Lola Bensky, the latest novel by New York-based writer Lily Brett, and that was read by Lily Brett. Now, Lola is a character that I almost wish I had the chance to be, a 19-year-old rock journalist who travels from Australia to London and America in the late 1960s, moving through the world of pop festivals and interviewing established and rising stars. Lily, can you tell us some of the famous names that Lola mixed?
Well, Lola basically interviewed almost everyone who was anyone in the mid-1960s. She interviewed Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Mama Cass, Jim Morrison, Brian Jones, Mick Jagger, Cher. It goes on and on and on.
Now, how much of Lola was or is Lily Brett?
Well, people always think my books are very autobiographical. And the truth is that there are parts of me in every character in this book, whether the character is male or female, they're all parts of me. And the other very clear truth is that I did work as a rock journalist in the 1960s, and I did interview everybody I wrote about in the book, and hundreds more.
Wow. Did you enjoy that time?
Did I enjoy that time? You know, that's a long time ago, and I'm not sure that enjoy was the right word. I was very earnest, and I wanted to write really good stories about everybody, and I really wanted to know who they were. I grew up with two parents who'd survived Nazi death camps, and my mother often said, "You will never, ever know what people are really capable of." And I knew that she knew, and it frightened me. And so knowing who people really were was something that was always very important to me. So I was sort of far more concentrated on finding out who they were and asking them questions. I guess it was a pretty exciting time when you look back, because it was the beginning of celebrity journalism. Mm. And you actually got to spend time with the celebrity. You actually went to the person's apartment. And it didn't occur to me that it was strange that I was in Mick Jagger's apartment by myself.
Do you think being a woman made it easier to access the musicians at the time?
No, I don't think so. I had a lot going against me. I was from an Australian rock newspaper, and naive enough to think that would impress people, but didn't at all.
Had they heard of it?
No, of course they hadn't heard of it in America. They hadn't heard of Australia. They asked me what language we spoke there.
So that was a Go Set magazine, was it?
Yes. And I think that the field was dominated, as many, many fields are, by men. So most of the journalists working in rock were men. I don't think it helped me that I was a woman, really.
So do you think it's interesting that two of the world's first female rock journalists, you and Lillian Roxon, did come from Australia?
Yeah, that's very interesting. She was fabulous. She was somebody who meant a great deal to me, and I learned a lot from her. But yeah, it is interesting. I think Australians have a courage and a naivety. They just turn up and assume
that they can do the job.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she was Australia's first female foreign correspondent.
Oh, right. I didn't realise that.
Yeah. She was a remarkable woman.
I read that you said that it was taking a while to write this book, Lola Bensky. Was the book always burning away, or had you forgotten about it?
No, I hadn't forgotten about it, but it was a part of my life that I didn't talk about much. I didn't think about writing it, except that so many people asked me why I never wrote about it, and I think I just had other things that I needed to write and wanted to write. And when I decided that I did want to write about it, it just took me ages to face writing about it. I think it's quite hard to face your 19-year-old self.
Quite revealing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not worried about being revealing, because I'm appallingly revealing in my books, shockingly so. I mean, I do it because I really very badly want to connect with a reader. So I try to be as truthful as I can so somebody else will have felt and understood exactly the same.
Well, I think it's interesting you said that because I've found Lola to be a wonderfully self-deprecating character. She's always concerned about her appearance and behaviour. And I think she comes across very easily related to, almost like an every woman, I don't know.
Yes, was her appearance. By appearance, she was just fixated by wanting to be slim and going on yet another diet.
But I think we all know many people like that.
Yes.
Now, while there's a lot of humour in the book, you do insert stories of the horror and death and the ongoing pain of the German Holocaust. Are these the stories that you really want to tell? Are your books vehicles for those stories, perhaps?
Well, they're not stories to me. They're part of my life.
Yeah.
And I think they're very, very important in many, many ways because if they make one person think about the danger of deciding that somebody else, because possibly the colour of their skin or their religious beliefs or their sexual orientation or even the music they play is not quite as human as you are, that is the road to catastrophe. And it's very important to me to show that no matter how we live or how differently we appear to live, we are all the same human being.
Do you feel a burden? Do you feel a compulsion, obviously, to keep this alive?
It's not a burden. No. It's just a need. It's a need to move somebody in some way. And also it's part of me, you know, it's just part of every breath I take. It's shaped me enormously as a human being. And it's shaped me as a writer.
That was New York-based Australian author Lily Brett there in conversation with Kate Braston. And here is Lola by The Kinks, as recommended by Lily.
I met her in a club down in Old Soho, where you drink champagne and it tastes just like Coca-Cola. C-O-L-A, Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said hello. Spine, oh my Lola,
I love the diversity at 2SER.
Oh, the diversity of opinions and views.
I love the different views and opinions on air.
I love 2SER because of its diversity.
I love the diversity.
I love the diversity.
I love the way 2SER is so diverse and there's no playlists and you get to play whatever you want. Stuff other stations don't play.
Share the love. Support Real Radio. Call 9514 9500 or go to 2SER.com.
This is the final draft, and as you're hearing, it's Supporter Drive here at 2SER this week. We're asking you to help keep us on air for another year of quality community radio. Supporter rates range from $35 for concession to $600 for lifetime lovers of excellent radio. Every single supporter will receive a 2SER keyring and a Spunk Records compilation, which features Ty Segall, M. Ward, Henry Wagons, Yeasayer, Bear Hug, and much, much more. For $150, passionate supporters will get that, as well as a limited number of Sony headphones, along with these lovely 2SER t-shirts we've got that were designed by a UTS visual communications student, part of a competition we ran earlier this year. They come in black or white, and the design is a drawing of an old school radio. And if $150 is stretching the bank a little, but you'd still like a shirt, you can buy one for $30, and all proceeds go towards keeping the station on air. Give us a ring now and help us out on 9514 9500. This year we've been broadcasting some new stuff, such as experimental audio piece The Idea of South on 3 digital radio channels simultaneously. And we've also held training courses here at 2SER for hundreds of students and others, including people with special needs who want to tell their stories on radio. So if you've been enjoying those stories, why don't you show your love for 2SER by pledging your support on 9514 9500.
2SER
107.3 FM.
John Freeman is sort of like the ultimate book lover, the book lover's book lover. Reading is his job. He was made editor of Granta, the British literary magazine, at the age of just 35, 2 years ago. In his career, he's interviewed hundreds of writers from all over the world and has been published in New York Times Book Review, LA Times, The Guardian and The Wall Street Journal, among many others. The list of writers he's spoken to is something of a book nerd's dream. How's this? David Foster Wallace, Haruki Murakami, Geraldine Brooks, Tom Wolfe, Philip Roth, Dave Eggers, John Updike, Don DeLillo, Paul Theroux, Norman Mailer, Salman Rushdie, A.S. Byatt and Margaret Atwood, just for a start. But it's not just about unravelling writers and finding out how they tick. The interviews are as much about his delicate way of proffering a new view of these titans of fiction as they are about those titans themselves. I called John in New York to talk about life-hopping, the responsibilities of the interviewer, and what it feels like to see a decade's worth of conversations brought together on the page.
It feels a bit surreal, to be honest, because in everyone's head, we're always aging a lot less fast than we actually are. And so in my head, I'm still somehow a kid from Sacramento, California. And I think, what the hell was I doing sitting down with Toni Morrison and Philip Roth and Doris Lessing and all those writers? And I guess the other thing I think about when I see the pieces put together is there's probably about 2 years of missing sleep here because they were all written on deadline.
When you're looking at a career like yours and the interviews that you've done, how do you determine who you're including and who you're excluding?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I had about 200 interviews to choose from, and I think there are about 50 or so, 55 here, and the ones that I chose were people that inspired me, really, the people that were as inspiring in person as their books were on the page. And I tend to look at people who have to write, you know, that feel compelled to write, that feel like they're sort of witnessing something or have to bear testimony to either their own lives or the lives of their countries as seen through imaginary characters. And so when I was putting the book together, there were some writers that I quite enjoyed as stylists, but when they were put next to people like Peter Carey or Ngugi Wa Thiong'o or, again, Toni Morrison or Louise Erdrich, I didn't want to put them in there because it wouldn't be a fair comparison for them to have their lives next to the life of someone like that.
Yeah, yeah. And the way that you've curated it is interesting as well. I mean, some of it is a little more natural. Like, for example, you have Nadine Gormina following Gunter Grass defending his SS pass. But then there's others that are a little more esoteric. Did you go along a timeline or did you just look for people that kind of flowed naturally into one another in terms of, you know, their lives and their work?
Yeah, there's some that are actual friends and spiritual blood brothers. And then there are other people who are more tangentially related, like Oliver Sacks and Imre Kertész, the Hungarian Nobel laureate, who's really kind of lived a life of the mind. And Sacks has sort of written entirely about the mind and the way the mind can trick us. And earlier in the book, I think I put Jonathan Safran Foer and Haruki Murakami together because they have these very plastic imaginations, and they deal, both of them, with horrific things, but neither of them have technically experienced them, but they're imagining their way into it, and that's what's kind of remarkable about their work. So it was fun to kind of try to pick those threads out, and to be quite honest, my editor, Carol Cooper, was really good at that, because when I put this together, I saw some of these connections, but she saw a lot more.
And she's got the distance as well from the interviews. Perhaps she doesn't have those personal memories that you have of what it was like and where you were and, you know, any emotional attachments that you might want to keep them in for.
Yeah, no, because there's always things that are left out of interviews, not because they're embarrassing or because they're inappropriate, but, you know, with Toni Morrison, it was quite stressful to sit down with her because her work is a kind of monument, and she knows exactly what she's accomplished and how she's done it. So to interview her is in some ways to kind of pass a test. And I don't like to focus on my own feelings going into an interview because I feel like the interview is about the writer, not myself. But
it is about you. I mean, as much as they are the focus, it's you that's drawing them together. And I mean, it's interesting as well, in your introduction you talk about tracing your life over that of another writer's and then how things might, you know, unexpectedly fall apart. And you have Margaret Atwood talking about perceptions of self and this idea that you are the story that you write. I mean, what lesson do you take out of speaking to so many novelists in that vein?
It is kind of a creepy act of a life hopping in a way, because I think what's marvelous about reading, especially fiction, is it gives you a chance to live out the lives that you never could have yourself, or lives that are different to yours but somehow reflect on your own. That's why you can sort of travel around the world in books. But when you read about writers, it's you're not reading about a book, you're reading about another life. And so going through their lives one after the other, it's like seeing a series of obsessions played out very quickly, because it took me about 10 years to interview all these people, but the book takes probably maybe 4.5 hours to read, and it's dizzying personally to read through it again, because I see, you know, when each interview took up sometimes up to a month of preparation, and then it's over, you know, fairly quickly. The longest piece is maybe a little over 2,000 words. And so what I wanted to do when I put them together and edited them is to make sure that they felt momentous, even if they were short, because that's how it felt meeting each one of these people.
Mm. A lot of the writers you interviewed seem to be straddling two places, and they talk a lot about displacement. Is there something inherently displacing about being a novelist and moving back and forth from reality to fiction?
I think so. I think novelists are inherently watchers. They're other. They're on the margins. And I think to be that way is both a gift and a curse, because you're always participating but with an eye of the distance between you and the action, you and the world, you and your friends, you and your relationships. And that distance is what allows writing to exist. It's the miraculous distance that I think makes writers who they are. And for some people, a lot of people, it is that kind of sense of winding up somewhere much different than they thought they would. And so there are a lot of migrants in this book, but there are also sort of spiritual migrants too, and people who are intellectual migrants, people who grew up, very blue-collar, as Joyce Carol Oates did. But she's, you know, probably the most important and erudite woman of letters in this country, in the U.S., that is. And I think those journeys from one place to another, even if it's intellectual rather than one of distance, are exciting to read about, because it, for me, it makes me think that things, remarkable journeys, are possible.
Hmm. Insofar as your responsibilities to the writers go, I mean, in a lot of the pieces you've included people saying things like Siri Husvedt saying that, you know, it's the things that get casually mistaken in profiles, or Don DeLillo talking about unmaking himself in interviews, or John Updike saying that people forget that writers are people with feelings. I mean, what responsibility do you feel to them?
I feel a responsibility to depict them accurately. That's one, and that's a joint one to the reader and to the author. And I, of course, an author sometimes can disagree about what is accurate about them or not. But I think the larger responsibility is to understand where they're calling from. And that's what's so exciting and so stressful about interviews, is that you have a limited amount of time as an interviewer to sit down with someone, but you have to really kind of put yourself in their shoes, and yet as a journalist not have the wool pulled over your eyes. And I don't follow the kind of tabloid or even pseudo-tabloid idea that there's a gotcha moment in interviews, that you want to get someone to confess, that you want to get someone to admit to something, because I don't really think writers work that way. You know, they work mostly in the dark by themselves in a solitary occupation, and when they come forward, there's a big moment of trust that they have to put both on the public as their readers and then the press as their interpreters. And so I tried to give people the benefit of the doubt, even if the way to reveal them was to show them explaining themselves, like someone like Norman Mailer, who talks and talks and talks about being Norman Mailer. But that's okay. That's the way he presents himself.
That's Norman Mailer.
Yeah.
It seemed to be as much an exercise of you exercising the skill of interviewing as much as it is the writers themselves being interviewed. And I think it's with Edmund White where there's a quite a funny passage where you're musing on what to actually ask someone that has lived so much and done so many things. I mean, how do you even go in at some of these people?
Yeah, it's hilarious because Edmund White has written so much about his life. He's written, at this point, I think upwards of four memoirs. And the memoir that I interviewed him for, he had admitted to some quite scandalous or, exciting sexual practices, however you want to describe it. You know, it doesn't leave an interviewer a lot to ask. Alternatively, there was Kazuo Shiguro, who, when I interviewed him, told me this was the first of probably 200 to 250 interviews he would give about that book, the book called Never Let Me Go. And I just thought, wow, you know exactly what you're doing in this conversation. And so by the end of the conversation, I was sort of second-guessing everything we said, which is a very Ishiguro moment because he's so full of sort of dissembling narrators who aren't totally telling you the truth until the final page. And we were sitting in a London cafe having high tea, and he was describing to me how to have tea properly the English way. And here's a Japanese Englishman saying, you have to cut the scone in half and then put the cream down and then spread the jam on like blood on fresh snow. And I just thought, is this a performance? Is this sort of carefully constructed for the interview, or is this you just being you? And you never know. So I tried to edit down what people were presenting and then present a narrative out of that.
John Freeman there, editor of Granter magazine and the man behind How to Read a Novelist, one of the more comprehensive and impressive collections of author interviews you're likely to find. And that's all for tonight. I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. If you did, please consider signing up to show us some love this week during Subscriber Drive. You can chat to one of our very friendly volunteers on 9514 9500. Every subscriber gets a prize, and don't forget that you will also go into the major prize draw to win a whole year's worth of entertainment with Belvoir Theatre tickets, CDs from Inertia, gigs at the Basement, Hopscotch DVDs, Palace Cinema tickets, and an Ox digital radio. There's also brand new 2SER t-shirts, Sony headphones, and Pete's Ridge Festival tickets up for grabs, and you go into the daily prize draw to win a Shady fresh food hamper. So please share the love and help us keep bringing you awesome independent radio. Next week, I'll be talking to Louis Naura about his new book, Into That Forest, a story of children adopted by a family of Tasmanian tigers, set back in the 1880s. That's on Monday at 7. Until next week.